Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So let's start, and let's go to to April 1667. So April 1667 is about 20 years after Galileo had died. And it was about this time that Newton was making his important discoveries, which would only be published 20 years later. So that you situate yourselves, you know, in where we are in history. And in that month, April 67, Nicolaus Steno published a book where he argued, arguably for the first time, that stones found in dry land, which we call fossils today, were actually teeth of shark. Now, this discovery triggered what became his famous geological career, leading him to claim not only that the Earth has a history, but also that that history can be known through a series of principles today known as Steno's laws of stratigraphy. And because of that, he is known in certain circles as the founder of modern geology. Now, what is interesting about this book is that if you go to the front cover, you know, the title of the book has nothing to do with geology. It is called A Sample of the Elements of Myology, so myology being the study of muscles. He was an anatomist, he was writing a book about anatomy. But again, if you flip through most of the pages of this book, you won't find much that look like an anatomy book, and instead you find this. And you see that it is a book filled with lemmas, definitions, corollaries, and many, many diagrams. So it looks like Euclid's Elements in many ways. And not only that, it was also in this book that he made one of his most important anatomical discoveries, namely saying that women had ovaries. Until this time, many people called what we call today ovaries as female testicles. He says, no, they are actually ovaries, and they play a big role in sexual reproduction, and then many other people, some of his friends in the Netherlands, kept on doing this research. Now, how did it happen? Oh, and let's see what. Yeah, so how, so he was had been working on anatomy for many years when he made this geological discovery insight about the history of the Earth. That year, 1667, when he made the discovery of, you know, that fossils are shark's teeth, he also decided to study theology more seriously, leading to his famous religious conversion. He was raised Lutheran and became Catholic that year. This is probably the peak of his scientific career. He dedicates the morning hours to study theology and undertakes a major religious conversion. How did this happen? How he was able to dedicate so much time to that? How did he go from history of the earth to theology, and also even from anatomy to the history of the earth? And what was the role of mathematics in all of this story, right? So my argument is that Steno had a remarkable way to intersect disciplines in his work because of what I am terming a focused interdisciplinarity. So he was able to focus knowledge from different disciplines into specific research problems in a way that then functioned very well for his studies of the body, and then he carried that to studies of the Earth. Now, I'm also arguing that Steno is very famous today as, you know, a geologist, and also in science and religion circles. He became even a blessed. He was beatified by John Paul II. So he's also famous because of his religious conversion. But if you go to the 17th century and you ask someone there, you know, have you heard of Nicolaus Steno? They would say, oh yes, he's that very famous and accomplished anatomist. And so we have to understand Steno in the way that his peers understood him, in his own terms and the terms of those who knew him, and that was as an anatomist. And it's when you dive in into his anatomical contributions that you can really understand how he made the shift to the history of the earth and then on to theology. Now, studying the path that Steno took from these different disciplines, it's very important because it helps to answer important questions about science and the history of science. So why is the crossing of disciplines an important thing in science, right? How have areas of knowledge intersected in history? And there is a history of this. We just had two talks about what Thomas Aquinas thought about these things. And this was going on in Sinus Simon. It's going on today. But in different ways. And in fact, another question is, do modern disciplinary boundaries, so our understanding of modern disciplines, apply well to the past? And so my goal is to use Steno and his scientific career to kind of answer these questions. And by doing that, also to try to understand who else was doing these things in the scientific revolution besides the very famous names of Galileo and Newton that we all know about. Now, who was Nicolaus Steno? He was born and raised in Copenhagen. That's why he was a Lutheran. Copenhagen was, Denmark was Lutheran. And then he traveled to the Netherlands, where he got his medical degree at the University of Leiden, a very important university at his time. Then he spends a year in Paris before, you know, short travel back home. Then goes to Montpellier and settles down in Florence after a brief trip to Rome. All of these stops are very, very important. And we'll figure that out as we go through this talk. This was the time in which the new scientific academies were being formed. The most famous one was the Royal Society of London, of which Newton becomes president many years later. And in fact, when in Montpellier, Steno becomes friends with many of the early members of the Royal Society. In Paris, he's also part of the circles of the Académie des Sciences in France. And in fact, he gets a job offer to stay there. But where he really wants to go is to Florence, where this older academy, the Accademia del Cimento, as it was known, the Academy of Sciences sponsored by the Medici court and formed by the disciples of Galileo, was going on. And everyone knew about this. In fact, the Royal Society and the Accademia des Sciences were in part made because we want to, you know, imitate what the Italians are doing, because they're doing it very well. And so Steno goes to Florence. Now, there's so many things that I can tell about this story. As Father Thomas said, I've written a whole book about this. What I want to focus today is on Steno's interest in mathematics. How did that come about, and how did that play out in his anatomical work and in his geological work? So let's go back to Copenhagen. Steno studied before going to university into a grammar school. It was a cathedral school of Copenhagen, which is a liberal arts school. He learns the seven liberal arts. So grammar, he learns Latin, Greek, and one of them was mathematics. And he studies mathematics there, the basics of math. We actually know that mathematics was one of his favorite topics, because later on he will write that he had dedicated many hours in the past to the study of geometry. And we know what that past was, because he says that he would treat mathematics not as my primary, but as my only work. His threatened circumstances at home had not so much convinced as forced me to prefer the useful to the pleasant. And we know that he goes to the University of Copenhagen to study medicine, not mathematics. And so this time which he dedicated solely to math was in the cathedral school. How did Steno develop this interest in math? Well, one of the reasons, I think, is because of the rector of this school, who was really formally a theologian, but was working hard on mathematics, a man called Georgius Hilarius, to whom Steno dedicates his first anatomy book, and in fact calls him a mathematician and a man of letters. Now, Hilarius was writing a book on Euclid's Elements, a textbook on Euclid's Elements, that comes out right after Steno graduates from his high school. And so Steno probably used, you know, the manuscript of this book as his own book to study Euclid's Elements, both in Greek and Latin. And in fact, it was there that he learned the basic things of geometry, including, for instance, what is a rhomboid or a parallelogram, which is a figure that has equal sides, equal opposite sides and equal opposite angles, but it is not a rectangle, okay? In fact, he didn't know, but he would use this exact figure to describe muscles many years later. So after he finishes high school, he has to go and do, you know, prefer the useful to the pleasant. Maybe his parents asked, you have to study medicine. Who knows what they said? That's certainly what they say today. And so he went to the University of Copenhagen to study medicine. So the question is, how do we know what he studied there exactly? How did he foster his other interests? Well, we actually have access to his notebook from those years. In fact, a notebook that he wrote in his final year and that he carried all around him throughout his travels, and it is now in Florence to be read and studied. And Steno was trained as a humanist, and humanists had to know how to master all this information coming out of many books. And one of the tips that, you know, people knew about was this idea that it is no waste of time to take notes, but rather to read without taking notes, which is, I think, good advice for us as well. In fact, you shouldn't read a book without a pencil in your pocket because you're going to forget it in so many ways. And Steno definitely did that, taking so many excerpts of everything that he was reading and studying. Now, as you start taking notes, you know, at university, as you're reading, whatever, you start to realize that it is probably a mess. You know, how do you make sense of your notes? And Steno, too, thought his notes were a mess, and he called them chaos. So this manuscript is called the Chaos Manuscript. It's also beautifully dedicated in the name of Jesus, as you can see, Nomine Jesu. But he called it a chaos, and it is a chaos of information, mostly in Latin, but has Greek, German. It is already transcribed and translated into English, and even that is very hard to figure out what's going on there. But there are some patterns within this chaos, which Steno, of course, knew very well, and you can grasp that as you flip through the manuscript. And so, for instance, if you see here, this is one of the pages of the manuscript, and here's another page. And the difference between these two pages is that the one on the left has lots of annotations in the margins. There's also some more underlinings, some nota bene's there, which you don't have that. And in fact, there are three major parts of this manuscript that are heavily annotated that tell us a little bit where were his interests at the time. So let's cover some of those parts. We won't go through all of them, but one of them, perhaps the most important, are his notes of a man, of the works of a man called Pierre Gassendi. Who has heard of Pierre Gassendi before here? Okay, more than average, but less than half of the room. So Gassendi is a major 17th century philosopher. You know, every historian of science knows him. Historians of philosophy know him as well. And he is really the man who Christianized Epicureanism, which is the Greek idea that all the world is made of atoms, particles in motion. So it is because of Gassendi, who was, by the way, a Catholic priest, that the idea of atoms that everyone knew about from the ancient Greeks became popular, because he described how it could be harmonized within a Christian worldview. And in fact, when you go to England, all the writers writing on atomism and corpuscularianism were vernacular, you know, translating Gassendi into English and paraphrasing that and making it to extend, so, you know, to wider audiences. So massive influence in European thought and, you know, underlying a major idea of modern science in many ways, which is the idea that the world is made of atoms. Now, another man, and so Steno read his work and annotated it carefully and studied it very carefully, but another man that was saying similar things at this time was called René Descartes, whom Steno also read, but not as intensively as he read Gassendi. But what he noticed is that, look, we have these new theories, these new mechanical philosophies, as they were known at the time, and but they are incompatible. So how do we solve this? So in the Scientific Revolution, so, you know, 16th, 17th century, scholars started to understand that what the ancients had said about nature, Aristotle, Plato, Hippocrates, Galen, was often wrong because of new discoveries, new things. And so how can we make sense of the world? And so there's all these new philosophies that are supposedly as comprehensive as the Aristotelian ones. These ones in particular were mechanical philosophies, but they are incompatible with one another. They explain some of the observations, but they don't make sense with one another. So which one is right? And Steno becomes obsessed with that, with what I term his search for certainty. And we see that playing out in his manuscript, in his notes. For instance, a major difference between Descartes and Gassendi is that Descartes does not believe in the existence of the vacuum, whereas Gassendi does believe that there is a possibility of empty space. And for instance, in his notebook, he sometimes writes prayers to God, and one of the prayers that Steno writes is he asks God an abstinence from a hasty and ill-considered judgment or opinion about something, unless it is known with great exactitude. So this rigor for exact knowledge is going to be very important throughout his whole career. Now, another book that Steno annotated very carefully was this book here, which you probably never heard of. In fact, this was one of the only two books that we know he read and certainly copied from cover to cover. And so this is a book written by a French anatomist called Jean Péquet. A very important book in the history of anatomy. So the most important scientific discovery at this time in anatomy was that of William Harvey, who discovered what? What did Harvey discover? Circulation of the Blood in 1628. This book is published in 1651, and Steno is taking notes in 1659. And so the major discovery, Circulation of the Blood, William Harvey, and Picquet is building on that and making more discoveries by opening up animals alive, which is the only way you have to discover things like the circulation. And Picquet discovers what is called today, and he calls it himself, the thoracic duct, which leads then to the discovery of the lymphatic system. So the system of the lymphatics, which is, by the way, discovered by a man called Thomas Bartholin, which was Steno's professor of anatomy in the University of Copenhagen. Now, this is a major book in the new, so-called new anatomy of the 17th century. But, you know, people who have studied the Chaos Manuscript have read it. Oh, Steno is, of course, reading, you know, new literature about anatomy. But just the significance of this book in the history of anatomy is really worth noting. But this book is more interesting because if you, again, flip through the pages, what you'll find is something like this. Physical mathematical experiments on the vacuum. It has nothing to do with anatomy. And in fact, Picquet was a member of the circles of French mathematicians made by Gilles Persson de Croberval, Marin Mersenne, Pierre Gassendi was there as well, Blaise Pascal was there as well, who were experimenting with Torricelli tubes. These new experiments that show that probably there is a vacuum in nature and making various experiments. In fact, Pascal's famous experiment of the Puy de Dôme, where he shows that air has pressure, is published in this book as well. And some other experiments are published here for the first time. Steno is reading this and is fascinated. It's in a way incorporating his mathematical and mechanical interests into anatomical work. And in fact, one of the quotes that he takes from the book is this one, which is, "He who deals with the physics of medicine without geometry sails through the ocean without a compass." Now, how do we know whether Steno really liked these or not? Well, just go to the textbook, and he wrote the double nota bene on the side of this quote, and then there's the other note, which is, "Sine geometria non tractanda physica." So natural things cannot be dealt with without geometry. Now, let's stop here. This is a remarkable statement for the time, but it doesn't seem unusual to us because today modern science relies on mathematics so much that we cannot see how innovative those claims were. But the thing is that in the 17th century, there was an ongoing battle about the uses of mathematics in the sciences. Are they useful or not? Can we trust them? Can they actually describe the natural world well? And in fact, as you may know or may not know, the leading actors in this story were Jesuit mathematicians. And there's multiple books about these. I'll just recommend two of them. So Peter Deere's Discipline and Experience and The Scientific Counter-Revolution by Michael Gorman. Not the same. but it's a well-known chapter in the history of science that Jesuit mathematicians were writing so many textbooks about mathematics that really everyone was reading. And Steno himself was reading those too, and in particular the work of a man called Athanasius Kircher. And Kircher, in the book that Steno reads, says that mathematics has many ways in which it concludes from falsities and impossibilities true and absolutely certain things. And Steno, when he's copying down this to his notebook, he writes, "Only mathematics deduces truth from false principles." Now, you can see how Steno was developing and fostering his interest in mathematics in his anatomical and medical studies in Copenhagen. Then he goes to the Netherlands, and in the Netherlands he starts publishing his first research, doing it in his first books, and it's major in anatomy. So here's just a sample. He describes very clearly all the salivary glands, all the glands in the head that produce saliva, and so the duct that carries saliva from the parotid salivary glands to the mouth is still called Steno's duct. If you go to Gray's Anatomy textbook, there it is, Steno's duct. He describes all the glands of the eyes very carefully, and then he starts studying the muscles, and in particular the heart. And so he's the first person to say that the heart is just a muscle and not a very special organ, as even William Harvey thought. Now, where is mathematics in all of this? Well, he was using a lot of mechanical analogies. And again, if you go back to Father Philip Neri's talk, mechanics by this time was a mathematical science, was a mixed mathematical science or subalternated science. And so everyone, including Steno, understood this as a mathematical science, right? And so what does he do? He describes glands as filters of blood. He says that glandular secretions are just lubrication fluids of the body, and he uses this example of a boat needing a third element to move on faster. He speaks of veins as siphons, just like Pequet had been doing in his book that he was reading. And he describes mussels as pulleys, again, speaking of these very specific Dutch pulleys that he had seen in Amsterdam. And he also uses lots of chemical analogies that I won't go into right now, but for instance, if you say that the blood is carrying glandular secretions, which are then filtered out through the glands like saliva, he says, it's kind of in the blood, and then the glands in the head kind of filter it out. And then people say, well, but the blood is uniform. And he says, well, you just use chemistry. You can have things that look uniform but contain different substance underneath. And he uses various examples of chemistry, another example of interdisciplinarity. But anyway, his major mathematical application and analogy happens when he gets to Florence. Lovely city. Now, before I explain what Steno was doing, let's just pause. This is, he arrives in Florence in 1666. And if in the same year, if you go to Cambridge, you have a very young Isaac Newton taking his first classes in mathematics at the University of Cambridge under a man called Isaac Barrow, who held what is called the Lucasian chair of the University of Cambridge, which was then held by Stephen Hawking, for instance. And he probably attended Barrow's inaugural lecture, where Barrow said that there is no branch of natural science that may not arrogate the title of mathematical to itself. Now, Barrow, Newton, all these Jesuits that these people were reading, they were only talking about the classical mathematics, so optics, astronomy, motion, natural philosophy. What Steno will do goes way beyond what these people were even conceiving, even though it can be accommodated to this statement here. And so in Florence, Steno will say that the study of muscles must become part of mathematics. He's going to say even further, why cannot we not give to the muscles that which astronomers give to the skies and geographers to the earth? So why cannot the study of muscles become a subalternated science, just a mixed mathematical science as well? So what is it that Steno argues? He basically says that muscles should be understood as oblique parallelepipeds. Okay? And he says he's going to do this by presenting an explanation of all the terms, as is usually done by geometers in a synthetic order, and with the title of definitions. Now, why is this important? Why is this model important in the history of science? Well, the reason is that the explanation for muscle motion until this time will always used what a thing called animal spirits. Everyone since Galen until the early modern period, including a man called Descartes, who had the modern version of this theory, argues that muscle motion happens because of an influx of animal spirits into the muscles. And why is that? Well, if you look at me, I'm not particularly strong, but if you do this, you see the bicep kind of increases when you contract your muscle. So there's something that needs to go inside it to explain it. So there's animal spirits going into it. Now, Steno's argument is easier to understand in two dimensions. So you have these two rhomboids, these two parallelograms, right? And the one on the left is a relaxed muscle, and the one on the right is a contracted muscle. But if you see, the line CS is longer than the line CR. So it means it looks a bit inflated, right? But the thing is that if you know Euclid's book 1, proposition 35, the area of parallelograms is just base times height. So the area of these two, in a way, relaxed and contracted muscles is the same, Steno says. And so if you're making it three-dimensional, he says the volume is the same. The contracted muscle has the same volume as a relaxed muscle. So you don't need animal spirits to explain inflation. Geometry alone is enough. And in fact, Steno is happy just to say that. He says that the idea of animal spirits is built on an uncertain foundation. Now, in the same book where he writes this, he starts making his first geological claims, again, that, stones found in dry land were parts of sea animals. Now, this claim that fossils were, once of teeth of shark, for instance, was not necessarily new. So Steno is not making groundbreaking work there. And in fact, he knows that very well. All of these intellectuals since history have said the same. Aristotle, Isidore of Seville, Avicenna, Albert the Great know that many stones found in dry land were once teeth of shark or of fish or parts of it. And so Steno is a bit at awe that today, meaning in the 17th century, the true explanation of sea fossils has become very uncertain in his times, right? So we need to explain this, again, the problem of certainty. And in fact, if stones that you find now on tops of mountains, seashells, were once underwater, how can we have an earth like this now, where there's some water and there's some dry land? What happened? right? And so Steno lays down a series of principles and explanations, and that's where the novelty of his work comes into, to explain how was the earth once covered with water and is now what it looks today. And so he uses chemical principles to explain that two liquids can precipitate a solid, for instance. But again, he's going to use a lot of mathematical ideas. So first of all, he's going to use mathematical formalism, right? So just like he was building his lemmas on definitions laid down in the beginning, he's going to build his, what he first calls conjectures, on different historiae, which really means observations that he makes about the natural world. And but most interestingly, he's going to use geometrical diagrams to describe, you know, the formation of mountains and of the strata. So this is his famous diagram. Now, many people have seen this and said, oh, Steno is just basing himself on Descartes, who has done a similar thing 20 years before Steno. But there are two reasons why that is not the case. One is that Descartes' theory of the earth formation is very different from Steno's. So, for instance, Descartes talks about mountains rising up through the crust of the earth, whereas Steno talks about waters drying down. And so if you follow this diagram, 25 is the original earth, and 20 is the earth as you see it right now. So 25 is the, you know, the strata underwater, and then the water starts to dry. You see that, the drying on 24, and then it starts to collapse in 23, and then you have more water again in 22, and then same process happens in 21 and gives what you see today, but then there's now all these principles that he lays down to explain how to read the strata, right? And again, he had already been using geometrical diagrams intensely in his anatomical research, so in a way, there's nothing new to this. Now, before I conclude this story of Steno, I want to talk about also the social role of mathematics in Steno's career, which is, I think, very important as well, but I'll just do this faster. So Steno is connecting with lots of people as he's traveling through Europe, and in particular, when he gets to Italy, he wants to get a job with the Medici court, and so he goes to Rome to get recommendation letters. And the letters that he gets are from these three people, so two Jesuits and a layman. What do they have in common? They're all mathematicians. So Steno wants to pitch a job for the Medici court, as he's going to be an anatomist, the court's anatomist, but he needs to show that he is proficient in mathematics. And again, as soon as he lands there in Florence, he becomes very close friends with this man called Vincenzo Viviani, who is self-entitled Galileo's last disciple, who is the chief mathematician of the Medici court, and who collaborates with Steno in producing that book of the muscles. So he's a big partner to Steno in that sense, in a way copying what Steno was reading about Pequet working in France with his other mathematicians. He's now doing the same in Florence. And in fact, shortly after Steno gets this job at the Medici court, his main patron, Prince Leopoldo de' Medici, describes Steno to another diplomat, saying, "We have here a Danish anatomist, young of age, but distinguished in his work, accompanied of all kinds of praise, and a great geometer, which greatly benefits his work." But no one is talking about geology. And then, in fact, when his book, where he, you know, lays down the theory of muscles, but also of the fossils, comes out, Michelangelo Ricci, a mathematician in Rome, says that, "I can now foresee that we will rapidly see the expansion of this part of philosophy, with the example of the theory of the motion of projectiles, which was reduced to the geometrical method by Galileo, just like it happened with the substance of the muscles by Steno." Now, Steno keeps on working on geology. He writes a bigger book on geology with more mathematical methods in it. But as you know, because not because of his conversion, but because of his, I guess, his heart, he understands that he needs to give his life to a pastoral vocation and to priestly ministry. So he becomes a priest and then a bishop. And so his scientific research kind of becomes on pause because he has more things to do. He goes to Germany to tend to minority Catholic communities there, becomes friends with Leibniz as a bishop, and then dies in the north of Germany with fame of holiness, to the point that the Medici ship his body back to Florence, where it is now today, and is still there venerated by the faithful. And yet, you know, so Steno becomes very famous bishop in the Catholic Church at this time, especially among intellectual circles. And then almost 100 years later, when the Medici librarian is kind of wrapping down all these notes and trying to write down biographies of people who were working in Florence, the way he describes the report that he writes about Steno again 100 years later, he talks about, you know, it's a report on the death and actions of Bishop Steno, a most outstanding mathematician. So you know, to wrap it up, Steno's ability to cross, you know, different disciplines onto specific research problems, so first the glands, then the heart and muscles, and then the earth, is in part because he's trying to figure out a way to have certain answers about nature, but also because of his travels and his collaboration. So he was becoming friends with all these kinds of people that had different interests, and many of them resonated with him, and so he became close friends with them. And so Steno's contribution to early modern science, I think, is much bigger than just being a geologist or a champion of the dialogue between science and religion. He was really someone who was bringing in all these disciplines in very successful ways. So just like Galileo was using the geometrical method to describe the motion of projectiles, and Newton was applying the same principles to the motion of heavy objects here and the moon, so too, Steno was applying the geometrical method to the motion of muscles and the same principles to the body and to the earth. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.